It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferrick.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll find out why it looks like a ballot redesign won't be in the works before the upcoming election.
First, there's been a lot of news lately about how the internet can be a hostile environment for women, from stolen nude photos to threats and harassment.
These instances of harassment in the virtual world can have real-life effects on the victim. Some even consider them hate crimes.
Our next guest lays out the problems and what some women and online communities are doing to try to turn things around.
Danielle Keats-Citrin is a professor of law at the University of Maryland Law School, and she's the author of a new book called Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. Danielle, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me aboard.
Well, we talked to you back in January about the harassment women are facing online, and since then there have been a lot of high-profile examples of harassment that have gotten very ugly, including the nude celebrity photo leak. There was Zelda Williams, the daughter of Robin Williams, who left Twitter for a while after some harassment. Is the problem getting worse since we spoke last, or is this just par for the course these days?
Yeah, you know, the problem, I think, over time has gotten worse, and we're increasingly seeing the posting of nude photos of both, of course, celebrities, but individuals, you know, the everyday person. And what is heartening, though, and maybe, you know, your question was, are we seeing more of it? I also think part of it, too, is that we're paying more attention to it. You know, for years I've been writing about online harassment, and so often the response has been, turn your computer off. Boys will be boys. It's the internet, the Wild West. But, you know, I think we're increasingly paying attention to just how harmful it is. So it's increasingly prevalent because these network tools are so easy to use to, you know, essentially ensure that people are unemployable, undateable, and really at risk for physical harm. But I think we're also taking it more seriously.
It's interesting you talk about the boys will be boys attitude or silly kind of frat boy humor was sort of analogous to the way we used to view sexual harassment in this culture.
That's exactly right. So, I mean, sadly, the responses to online harassment for years have lined up so precisely in the way that we responded to sexual harassment in the workplace in the 60s and early 1970s, right? So we said, oh, it's a perk for men to enjoy in the workplace. It's what you expect, right? And we used to say about online harassment, it's the Wild West. It's the internet. You know, you can't really expect anything differently, right? And we once said that sexual harassment in the workplace, it's just these messy interpersonal matters. You know, we should say nothing about them. That's private issues. And we often say the same about online harassment. Oh, it's too messy to get involved. It's just, you know, pranks, juvenile nonsense. And we often blame victims much in the way that we did in the 1960s and 70s. So we said to women in the workplace then, oh, it's what you're wearing, you kind of asked for it, and if you don't like it, leave the workplace. And we say the same thing to victims today, right? We hear it even with this leak, you know, the theft of women's nude photos. It's the theft and hacking, right? And the response is, I was just on a radio show yesterday, and a sheriff said, well, really, you shouldn't take your nude photos, right? And so in some respect, what we're doing is saying, we're blaming victims. We're saying you shouldn't have the right or the liberty, if you want, right, to take photos that you don't share with anyone, right, and keep them for yourselves. And so it's just sadly lining up with the very same ways in which we've trivialized and minimized sexual harassment offline. We're doing the same online.
So as you pointed out, there's been a lot of different response to the leaks of these nude celebrities, women. Some people have blamed Apple, the hackers, some of them saying, you know, message to celebrities, don't take nude photos.
Yeah.
And other people have said, well, no, a woman should be able to own her sexuality, and this is part of it, but it should never have to be made public. How do you view what happened, and also from a legal standpoint?
Right. So, I mean, this is a question I have. Do we say to individuals whose social security numbers have been hacked in data breaches and whose SSNs then are traded and bought or appear online, do we say to them it's their fault that they shared their social security numbers with their banks or with, you know, their employer? We don't. We shouldn't say the same thing to people who have a rightful expectation of privacy, that privacy is invaded and then posted online. So I don't think we should treat the information any differently, but I think it's stereotypes and gendered stereotypes that lead us to that conclusion, right? So what's the legal significance of posting nude photos online was part of your question, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's both a tort and increasingly in some states it's a crime. So, you know, there isn't, when we think of the First Amendment, we protect we have every right to say very offensive and very hateful things. But there are certain categories of speech as a historical matter, we say, you know, we have less rigorous protection over them. And for private communications, we can protect private communications because essentially it's fostering private speech. So there are torts like public disclosure of private fact that when there have been sex videos of celebrities leaked, courts have both provided remedies and enjoined the release of those sex tapes because even celebrities have a right to privacy in their most intimate moments and the public has no legitimate interest in them. You know, over the last 18 months, there has been a move to criminalize invasions of sexual privacy. So there are now 14 states in which it's a crime to knowingly post someone's nude images, knowing that they expected them to be private and that they were shared in confidence or permitted to be taken in confidence, and that confidence is betrayed. I don't think Wisconsin is one of those states, but there are moves to criminalize it across the country, and I think that's exactly right.
Is there evidence that online bullying, threats, harassment has real life harm?
Absolutely, right. So these threats online and just the pervasive privacy invasions and lies that are spread about people, it's terrorizing, right? So some people fundamentally change who they are. Victims have changed their names because the first 10 pages of a Google search of their name is saturated with their nude photos and the suggestion they're interested in sex. They've moved because their home address is posted online, along with lies about them that they're prostitutes or available for sex, right? And it's hijacked people's careers. So, you know, I've talked to countless professionals who have lost clients, patients, and some individuals have lost their jobs. So teachers have been fired. And schools have explained, like, look, your nude photo appears online. We don't believe you put it up there, but we can't have an elementary school teacher having parents look at, you know, a teacher's, you know, Googling a teacher and seeing these nude photos. And Microsoft did a study in 2009 and found that over 80% of employers, you know, use Google as an employment, you know, research tool. And over 80% of cases, there's a negative result. And one of the key categories of why employers explain there's a negative result when they use Google as kind of a CV is unsuitable photographs. So it's not that I don't think employers necessarily believe that individuals are spreading lies about themselves and putting up their nude photos you know, that they're engaged in this information. It's just so much safer and easier to hire someone who doesn't come with this kind of baggage. And it's emotionally devastating to victims. Some victims have told me they're like, they can't stop Googling themselves for fear that more posts are going to go up. And it fundamentally chases people offline. So it's silencing. You know, we think of all the wonderful things that the internet offers us. And a key part of that, right, is self-expression and promotion and establishing your online reputation. And so many victims just plug out of online life because the more that they establish themselves, the more they're attacked.
Now, you go after this from a legal standpoint. I'm curious about what you think about the English classics professor Mary Beard, who...
Right.
was just profiled in The New Yorker about how she engages her attackers. Now, she's a public personality in England, and she gets a lot of really vile comments. Some of them are threats. But she, first of all, directly engages the people who are attacking her, and she also directs her followers, of whom she has tons because of her figure, her position.
Right.
And tells them, you know, to go after some of the people who are coming after her. And it's been pretty effective. This is not anything that happens within the bounds of law. But I wonder what you think about that approach.
Right. I mean, self-help certainly has its virtues, but let me explain why I think Mary Beard has been successful. I mean, so often, as she was explaining in that New Yorker piece, she's written directly to her attackers, so presumably she knows who they are or can figure out who they are. But so often, the victims that I talk to, they have, you know, they're not celebrities or well-known individuals, and they have no idea who anonymous attackers are. And so it's virtually impossible to write back and say, you know, if somebody sets up an attack site in your name or a fake online advertisement saying you're interested in sex, Like, who do you write to say, no, I'm not interested in sex, and please stop posting this, right? There's no really counter dialogue to engage in. So my sense of that story was that, you know, when she would reply via Twitter, you know, she could identify these folks or it, through other means. But so often victims have no idea who to engage with. And some of self-help, like, you know, just either having a dialogue, I think would be really valuable, right? Because victims would feel empowered. But the hard thing is that when I've had so many cases, and I discuss them in my book, where victims try to, strike back, whether it's, countering the messages that are sent about them, or even just establishing their own online presence in a positive way, mobs and individuals strike back even harder. So when individuals try, right, to protect themselves or even just to have a positive online presence, the strike back is so profound. So it's not that you can't have supporters help you and engage in counter Google bombs, right, to raise the prominence of positive things that's said about you online, but that's the rare case.
Well, we're talking right now with Danielle Citrin about online harassment of women, why it happens and what to do about it. Thinking about this in light of the recent nude celebrity leaks that we've heard about recently, what happened recently with Emma Watson when she launched the He for She campaign at the UN. And we want to know what you think about this. Are you a woman who's been harassed online? Do you think the internet is a safe place for women? Do you feel that women are unfairly targeted by cyberbullies? And what do you think should happen, if anything, to change that culture and to change the response that can happen legally and otherwise? You can let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue our conversation and take your calls right after this check of the headlines with Kristen Durst. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert with Rob Ferret, and we're back with Danielle Citrin talking about cyberbullying and why women seem to bear the brunt of it online. And we'd like to hear from you on this. What do you think can, maybe should be done to make the internet more welcoming and safer for women? And how have you seen online harassment evolve over the years? What should or can be done about it? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. And we go to our callers now. We've got Rick with us in Grafton. Hi, Rick.
How you doing?
Good, thanks.
I've got about 30 years experience in IT, and the last 14 or so have been with a great team that worked with government agencies and individuals to find people who try to steal money from banks, hack banks, et cetera. And I've left that position and now got a little more time on my hands. And I also have a daughter who unfortunately, it's disheartening to know that not only online, but everywhere women go, it seems, are being sexually harassed. And it's really getting ridiculous. But my main point on the call is I would love to start a volunteer organization of existing and or retired information security professionals that have international experience to actually help these women actually identify the individuals harassing them. I think that once you have so-called neighborhood watch of the internet, of volunteers, sheepdogs, so to speak, to go after the wolves on the internet, I think, and then if they get publicized of catching these people and they get public, it'll cause a behavioral change if the government puts some real teeth into the penalties for harassment, period, but especially for women and children.
Okay, thanks a lot for calling, Rick. Appreciate that. What do you think about that, Danielle? A sort of internet neighborhood watch of volunteers.
I appreciate that comment so much because so often victims I talk to, and I work with a group called the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, so I want Rick to contact that group, which is basically an advocacy group that's trying to connect victims with pro bono counsel. And so often, victims can't sue. There are tort claims they could bring against their harassers, but they just don't have the money to hire a lawyer and to hire a computer forensic specialist to sort of track down their attackers. And so having sort of pro bono information security, you know, so technologists on the side of victims who can help them sort of trace who it is who's attacking them and then even provide that information to law enforcement, who so often do nothing about reports of online abuse, not not always because they don't get it and they don't care, but because they're just outpaced by the technology. They say, like, what's Twitter? I don't get any of this. And so I think with the help of or voluntary efforts of technologists, we could have some accountability for this abuse.
All right. Well, thank you for that call, Rick. And since a lot of online life right now happens on places like Twitter and Facebook, social media sites, what do you think about the way that those sites are handling these sorts of issues right now?
I mean, so there are sites and intermediaries who I think do the best that they can to address harassment and threats. So let's just take Facebook. They have fairly clear community norms and terms of service, but, you know, their scale is significant. So they've got 1.35 billion users, and they have four dedicated, you know, content safety teams with hundreds of people in different offices. But it's difficult to kind of respond to victims in a timely manner, and I think they can do a better job, but they're trying. So there are so many, I think, intermediaries who give us a lot of hope, right, because they want, you know, to have norms on their sites of respect. They're not saying that you have to say nice things to one another, but rather that you can't threaten and you can't harass and silence people. Of course, they're free to not do that. And there are other sites whose entire business model is revenge porn, right, or gossip. And so we have kind of the full range of online actors. So, you know, hopefully the efforts of Facebook's, those kinds of entities are an inspiration to others.
Danielle, what do you see as the root of this problem? Why do you think women are receiving the brunt of online harassment when it happens?
I mean, it's a difficult problem. You know, to answer that question, you know, sometimes we see that it's the sort of determined person who's a scorn lover who goes after someone and then inspires a cyber mob, right? And at bottom, we see it's you know, sort of driven by hate and bigotry, right? So that people feel threatened and they push down others. And it's cheap and easy to do with these network tools in a way that makes it difficult to find, you know, the perpetrator. But, you know, I should note that it's not just women who are targeted online. It's the majority is women. But men are targeted, too. And when they're harassed, it's very similarly in a sexually humiliating and sexually threatening way, right? So it's not just threats. It's rape threats or anal rape threats. Right? It's not just privacy invasions, but nude photos. And that's much more often women who are featured in these nude photos without the person's consent. And it's not just lies, but it's lies about someone's sexuality, right? So that they have herpes, that they have AIDS. So it's in a way, it sort of expresses bigotry, and it's a way that people are vulnerable, and that's the way in which we attack them.
Let's get one more call in here. Robin joins us next in Verona. Hi, Robin.
Hi. My daughter is on a TV reality television show right now, and the amount of tweets and emails that she gets from women far outweigh the ones that she gets from men, and they are so vile. They are so vicious. They're so violent. They're so hateful. They will say things like, you know, somebody should choke her. Someone should bash her in the face until she can't speak. Someone should put a plastic bag over her head. And these are all from women.
Wow.
And they far outweigh the men.
Okay, thank you so much, Robin, for calling and sharing that. Is Robin onto something? Is it unfairly assumed that it is men doing all this? It's often anonymous. Is it a civility issue that's more general?
Right. So, you know, it's actually true that women can torment, terrorize, right, other women in this way, right? And so there are cases of where the perpetrator is identified and it's a woman. So it's not to say that the gender is always of a man as the perpetrator, though there are studies that suggest that the majority of perpetrators are male, but that doesn't always line up that way. And I think the sort of the way in which we hate other people, we have self-loathing too, right? So women go after women and they express that hatefulness in bigoted ways because we know we're vulnerable in that way. So it's much scarier, right, to a woman to have a rape threat because the threat is so real. One out of every six women faces some experience with rape in her life. So I think it's true that the gender doesn't necessarily line up with how you might think about it, but it nonetheless has the same effect.
Danielle, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back. I really appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Danielle Citrin, a professor of law at the University of Maryland, and she's the author of the book Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
Environmentalists responded positively to President Obama's climate speech yesterday, but what role is Congress going to play in actually enacting any policy? It's our weekly look at Congress with Paul Singer.
But first, a judge dismissed a lawsuit today that aimed to redesign election ballots in Waukesha County before the November 4th election.
Republican legislative leaders filed the lawsuit against the state's Government Accountability Board, alleging that it was confusing and could influence the outcome of the election by giving too much prominence to Democrats.
Wisconsin Public Radio state government reporter Sean Johnson was at the hearing today in Waukesha, and he's with us now to get caught up on what happened. Sean, thanks for stopping back again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Republican legislative leaders had an issue with the model ballot in Waukesha County. What were their concerns there?
So what they said was that there wasn't enough differentiating the name of an office on the ballot from the first candidate for that office. And their concern was that if you, wasn't going to affect anybody running for governor, for example, but if you go on down the ballot to lesser known races, say for the state assembly, for example, that a voter would look at those offices and potentially think that there was only one candidate running for those offices and that they might not vote in those races. In Wisconsin, because Democrats won the presidential race here in 2012, state law says that they are listed first. Their candidates are listed first on the ballot in the next election. And so in this situation, it left a ballot where Republicans said, essentially it was going to give Democrats an unfair advantage.
Now, is this an issue that is specific to Waukesha County's ballots, or is this something that was statewide and would have popped up in other places on ballots?
This is something that was statewide. This is something that was filed in Waukesha County because of a state law that Republicans passed that lets lawsuits against the state be filed in any Wisconsin county. So traditionally in the past, these would be filed in Dane County, the seat of state government. But under this new law, Republicans are able to challenge, the Government Accountability Board in this instance anywhere. And so they chose to challenge the GAB in Republican-friendly Waukesha County. They did have success there in court challenges, on election-related challenges in 2012 during the recalls. But today, not so much. I mean, the judge was made pretty quick work of their challenge there. Heard about 25 minutes of arguments, read a couple of cases that one of the lawyers mentioned during those arguments and came back and ruled.
Wow, so 25 minutes it only took. What was the ultimate decision or why was it made?
Yeah, so it was about an hour after arguments started that the judge came back and said he was dismissing the case. Not necessarily the most exciting reasons for why he dismissed it, but he said, number one, that the campaign committees of Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald did not have standing to sue, that the committees had not been harmed. There'd been no injury. And so when you haven't been harmed, when you haven't been injured, you don't have access to the court system in a case like this. The other thing that he mentioned was that statutes require a challenge like this against the Government Accountability Board to first be filed formally with the Government Accountability Board. So Voss and Fitzgerald did not take that step. They went straight to the courtroom. The judge said state law basically just says you can't do that.
And what is response from the Government Accountability Board been so far to this dismissal?
They said it was the opinion that they were hoping for. And, Kevin Kennedy, the director of the Government Accountability Board, said you always have some type of controversy with ballots in any election. But, the idea that this was going to give some kind of a partisan advantage, he had referred to previously as absurd. One other thing that came up during arguments is that when the Government Accountability Board creates these model ballots as a template for clerks to use all over Wisconsin. Clerks don't necessarily follow suit. I mean, they don't have to, and in practice, they're not doing it. In this case, I mean, there are a number of counties with Democratic county clerks who said, we're not going to use the model ballots from the Government Accountability Board. We're going to use something else. It might be subtly different, but they have that autonomy to do something a little bit different than the state allows, and that is something that the judge noted before he issued his ruling in today's case.
Now, briefly, before we move on, I understand the judge also said that a voter should have been the one to bring this suit to the courts, not these committees. Is that likely to happen? Or is that something that would also have to happen after the election?
I don't know. I mean, the attorney for the Republican legislative leaders was asked about that, whether we would see a follow-up suit by a voter. And he just didn't have an answer for that. I suppose it, you know, that might hinge on how important Republicans think this issue really is. They've sort of made the Government Accountability Board a whipping boy in some of these cases where they really have gone after the board. They use it to kind of drum up support among their base. The GAB has been a frequent target of theirs. So, you know, it could have been some political motivation behind filing the suit as well.
So moving on to the very busy Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, we're still waiting for word about whether or not they're going to take up a case against Wisconsin's voter ID law with a full panel. What do you think is likely to happen there?
Yeah, so we don't know. I mean, we know that a three-judge panel a couple weeks ago heard Wisconsin's voter ID challenge, which had halted voter ID, you know, for a couple years, and just hours later issued an order that reinstated the law. So plaintiffs for the ACLU and other groups that wanted to block the case have asked the full Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals to hear the case en banc, you know, so you'd have every judge at the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals ruling on the case. They say that you can't reinstate voter ID this close to an election. So the response by the state has been, look, voter ID is happening. If you were to put the brakes on it again, the verb that they used is you'd be ping-ponging state election officials and voters. So it's really up to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. A majority of the judges there would need to vote to take the case. We don't know if that'll happen.
And what impact do you see if on voters and election officials if the voter ID issue remains intact between now and Election Day?
I think, as far as turnout goes, definitely remains to be seen. It's a lot closer to the election to implement this law than the Government Accountability Board or clerks had hoped. They say they're up to the challenge, but, you know, one of the initial difficulties we've seen with that is there have been almost 12,000 absentee ballots sent out without instructions that say you have to include some kind of a photo ID. What do you do with those ballots? Hundreds, at least, were already sent back. In other words, they were voted without sending in a photo ID. You know, that's if it's a close election, that's the type of stuff that could end up in a courtroom.
Now, Sean, before we let you go, there was some breaking news just moments before the show. We got word that the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals repealed the injunction by Judge Randa stopping the John Doe investigation. So what does this mean and where are we now?
Yes, it's been very busy at the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago. What that means is that the John Doe investigation, John Doe 2, as it's been called, is essentially back on. It had been halted by a federal judge in Wisconsin, Judge Rudolph Randa. He agreed with conservative groups that it was a violation of their First Amendment rights. You know, I have the opinion here from the Court of Appeals, haven't had a chance to go through it extensively, but they seem to be getting at what they said in oral arguments, and that is that it's not the place of a federal judge to get into the state court's business in this way and to issue an injunction blocking a state court proceeding. You know, those are some of the first words written here by Judge Frank Easterbrook, who wrote the opinion. And so what this means is that the federal court system's stop to this investigation, that this John Doe investigation in the state court system, has now been lifted.
So where does it go then? Back to the state court?
This thing has so many tentacles. Investigators have their own challenges in state court and, and getting some of the evidence that they obtained through subpoenas to be included as part of the record. They had a state court judge rule that those subpoenas were too broad. And I think it may come down to an interpretation of state statute when it comes to coordination between campaigns like Governor Scott Walker's and these conservative groups. But one of those branches of this investigation that took it off into the federal court system, it would appear through this ruling that argument has been closed, although, of course, these conservative groups could appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, Sean, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for coming on.
All right. Thank you.
We've been talking to Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio state government reporter, getting us caught up on a few issues in the courts today. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer.
The United States launched its first round of airstrikes against ISIS in Syria on Monday, stirring up more dissatisfaction among those who think a vote in Congress is needed to authorize military force.
And some environmentalists are applauding President Obama's climate speech at the UN yesterday. But what role is Congress playing in any of the policy he's seeking internationally?
Paul Singer joins us every week at this time. It's good to have you on, Paul.
Nice to be here. How are you?
Good, thanks. So let's start with the American airstrikes against Syria, which began on Monday. Pentagon spokesperson said this is only the beginning, and there have been calls in Congress for a vote to authorize military force. Now, this is, to say the least, sort of a sticky subject for Congress right now at this particular junction in time. Where do you think we are with that possibly happening before the elections?
Well, there's three kind of relevant things here. The first is that Congress voted a couple of weeks ago to approve the arming and training of Syrian rebel groups. So that was the first opportunity for Congress to really get on the record endorsing a public engagement of Syrian fighters by the U.S. military. They've been doing some of this kind of clandestinely in the past. But that authorization expires the second week of December. So at that juncture, Congress is going to have to vote on something. That also is tied to the year-long funding bill for the federal government. And to avoid a federal government shutdown, they'll have to extend the funding for federal agencies also on that same bill, middle of December. So there's a sort of a must-pass bill with an already passed provision on it. But both of those provisions give an opportunity for Congress to mess around a little bit. They could reconsider whether or not they want to vote again on the authorization to train and supply. They could be dealing with a funding request of some sort for the administration on this action. And then there's a third question of a standalone authorization of military force in Syria. That's the toughest one. Because at that point, you are essentially giving the president the authority to conduct a war. And that makes some folks in Congress very, very, very nervous.
Well, those first things you outlined sound like they could all be put off until after Election Day. But that authorization of military force specific to Syria, and if they don't do it now, it's maybe a weird argument to make not to do it now, but to do it 3 months after it started. Is there any kind of pressure to make something happen before November?
Nope. Nobody's coming back to vote on that. I can almost assure you, Congress is out of session. They have no intention to come back. I would be stunned if for some reason they decided to come back and have this vote before November 4th. Now, of course, I've been surprised before, but but then we get to the problem you're raising there, Rob, which is that, well, what's the point of voting to authorize military force if we've been using military force in the country for the past 6 weeks? It becomes kind of a moot point. Part of this is, I think, is going to depend on how this battle goes. I mean, if this becomes a bigger and bigger and bigger campaign over a period of time, and particularly if it comes to the issue of having Americans on the ground or killed, God forbid, in action on the ground, that's when Congress is more likely to swing into action.
And how much does this have to do with the fact that the elections are coming up, the midterms, and that this is a muddy situation?
Oh, almost everything has to do with the elections coming up. I mean, I think that's part of the issue, right? Is And I also give these guys a certain amount of credit. I mean, it's early enough in this campaign. It's a little unclear to everybody what's happening, what's going to happen, what the outcomes are going to be, what the end point is, what the long game is, what the long view is for the United States. I think that for Congress, voting on an authorization of military force that might be in effect for many years is a little bit of a dicey situation because they're not sure what they're buying. They don't know exactly what this war is going to look like. And you can tell even now, okay, we've got airstrikes going on. We're not sure how many of them are Americans. We don't know how many of them are other nations who are conducting airstrikes on our behalf. It's just, I think there is a serious concern amongst members of Congress about not wanting to get out ahead of this train. Except, of course, in a couple of cases, you know, I think the John McCain's of the world, the hawks who really believe that the military might of the United States is our most important role in this part of the world, easier for someone like McCain to vote on this, harder for somebody who might be running for re-election or running for president in 2 years.
Well, moving on to another issue on the world stage, President Obama made a speech at the UN yesterday calling on the world to be more ambitious about stemming climate change, trying to put pressure on China to play a bigger role. So when President Obama makes speeches like that, that pitched kind of to an international audience, how much do they matter domestically and they have in your relationship to what Congress might vote on, probably not soon, but say in the next year?
Yeah, that, you know, Obama is making an appeal that I think you fully understand, right? There's not a lot the Americans can do to fight climate change by ourselves. Some of the heaviest emissions that are contributing to climate change are taking place overseas. Some of what the United States is trying to do is to help economic development in those countries in a way that is more sustainable and more emissions friendly, as it were. But almost none of that involves Congress, and Congress has made it very, very clear they don't want to do a whole lot on environmental issues. And you've seen, you know, if any of your listeners watched Jon Stewart and The Daily Show, they saw a funny little takeout a couple of nights ago on the House Science Committee that was basically complaining a lot about any kind of effort to regulate greenhouse gases or even to address climate change. So I wouldn't expect Congress to vote on much, and I wouldn't expect the president's speech at the UN to encourage or to push Congress to do much. I mean, honestly, and I mean this in, you know, with no criticism of the president, the fact of the matter is that this UN trip is going to be remembered for what he said about war in Syria, not what he said about climate change. So that's the topic that's going to come home, and particularly to Congress, is going to be war in Syria. For the near foreseeable future, I don't expect climate change to be a point of conversation, particularly if the Republicans win the Senate next year.
And, you know, on another point there, does the president have the credibility to be making a speech like this? Reportedly last year, India, China, and the United States were among the top carbon emitters.
Right. Well, I mean, he can say a lot of things about things we want to do, things we'd like to do, things we should do. My recollection is, and I'm not a climate change expert by any stretch of imagination, my recollection is we could never get the U.S. Congress to ratify treaties, you know, that would bind us to any of these targets. So, you know, it's hard for the United States in general to demand that other people cut their emissions when, as you said, we are not the best actors on our own front. But on the other hand, you know, Obama is pushing regulations to ratchet down emissions from power plants, one of the biggest sources here in the United States. So it's not like we are not taking the challenge seriously at some level. Whether that's enough to convince international partners to play along, I don't know.
Lastly, before I let you go, Paul, I know you at USA Today are keeping track of the role women are playing nationally in the race for the Senate. Yep. To what extent is the future of the Senate in the hands of women in office?
Well, it's, you know, it's both in the hands of women in office, and in some cases, I think it would be very clearly, and women voters are going to be very, very key in some of these races. You know, if the Democrats can motivate women to vote for Michelle Nunn in Georgia, for instance, that's a seat that the Democrats think might be in play, a Republican seat that might be in play. Obviously, if the Democrats are going to still have control of the U.S. Senate next year, it's going to be because a woman named Mary Landrieu managed to survive her re-election bid in Louisiana. It might be because a woman named Jean Shaheen survived her re-election bid in New Hampshire. You know, there are a lot of women candidates that the Democrats are relying on Kay Hagan in North Carolina, another one, women incumbents who Democrats are relying on to save their majority. Now, also a couple of women Republicans running that will be interesting. Shelley Moore Capito from West Virginia is almost certain to be the next senator from West Virginia. She's a Republican.
Paul, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Have a great day.
You too. That's USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us each week at this time to talk about the latest news from Congress.